This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Joining us for this episode is Dave Stennell, who looks back over a varied career working for a number of leading financial institutions.
David Stennell, welcome to Treasury Matters. We're delighted to have you here. David has been a long-time supporter of Alma and has held a number of positions, including Chief Administration Officer, but has also been around the Treasury scene for many, many years. So, Dave, how did you get into banking and Treasury?
Thank you for that welcome, Chris. Delighted to be involved in this podcast. How did I get into banking and Treasury? Completely by accident. I had absolutely no intention of having a career in finance, which 45 years later seems a rather bizarre notion. From back then, all I wanted to do was earn enough money to buy a PA system for the band that was going to take me to international stardom. Well, me, like millions of others, pipe dream, it didn't happen. So I joined a bank, Yorkshire Bank, actually. I was given 7 offers in different banks. It was a different time, easy to get a job. And I chose them because they seemed like a very nice bunch of people who paid my expenses on the interview. Such was my banking career ambition. Anyway, what I found over the next few years, around 8 to 9 years with Yorkshire Bank, that it provided an extremely good foundation for a lot of what was to come. Obviously, I didn't know what was to come. So that's how I got in. I was nowhere near Treasury at that stage. That came later.
So, Dave, you've been in banking for a while. How did you actually get into Treasury?
Well, up to that point, my career had been in and out of bank branches and head office departments. So by the time I'd given up my musical ambitions, it was clear that banking was something that I was enjoying, and I was enjoying the experience and the career progression. My career had gone pretty well, so I was well into the managerial grades when I was selected out of the blue to go to the bank's treasury, which was in the city. But it was seen at that time as a stepping stone to general management and nothing more. So it was a fairly unusual approach that Yorkshire Bank took at the time to populating its treasury and actually running it. But by the time I'd got down there, I really thought that I'd found something that excited me. Not only the environment of the city, but the subject matter and the instant gratification of some of the things we were doing. That was a different time back then. But post Big Bang, there were probably about 450 banks in the City of London, many of them foreign branches, that were active in the sterling money market. And it was very actively traded environment, one that I don't think anyone who does that job right now would recognize or probably really appreciate how vibrant, volatile, and intoxicating an environment it was. So that was my introduction. And having spent a couple of years doing that and picking as many brains as I could, I was then invited by Yorkshire Bank to go back to their head office in Leeds and manage one of their head office departments, which from a career progression point of view sounded quite good, but from an enjoyment standpoint was a total turnoff. So it was at that point that I decided that Treasury was for me and I'd better find somewhere else to apply my trade. And again, back then, it wasn't that difficult to find a good home. So I moved from there into a building society, which if you're listening to that now, it might sound quite an odd move. But back then, building societies had just been empowered by some legislative changes that gave them much broader access to wholesale markets. So the way in which the large societies responded, and of course, there is only one large society now nationwide, but back then there were quite a few with sizable balance sheets. So they were sort of hooking people out of the city to help them to develop these new capabilities and access new markets. So I was one of those people. And I went into an incredibly helpful environment from a career standpoint, but also one where I learned what I would say were the basics of what I've been doing over the rest of my career. I learned a lot of good things. So at Cheltenham and Gloucester, would you believe? So this is over 30 years ago. You know, I've worked or in or given advice to or been exposed to a number of banks and building societies, you know, maybe more than 20 or 25 during my career. If I had to point to one which did stuff like funding, liquidity management, and structural risk management better than most, it would be Cheltenham and Gloucester. And that's 30 years ago. Not an awful lot changes, really, certainly not in terms of the basics. And from them, Chris, it went into Lloyds Bank, where I was essentially a trader for a while, running their interbank operation, which was, at the time, they were the largest bank by capitalization in the world. So, you know, anyone could have made money running that book. So it sounded rather glamorous, but in actual fact, it wasn't particularly edifying. So I graduated into capital markets activities and learned quite a bit there. So again, I was just sort of filling out my capability during that time, but it was a real eye-opener in terms of what I thought was going to be a lot of sophistication that I would find in a large organization. It was strange in that some of the things that I learned in the smaller firm, they didn't know in the larger firm. Again, that's something that's useful for people to think. You know, don't just assume that you're in a big place, that you're going to be best placed for developing your career. And I went from there into a couple of years running part of an interdealer brokering company, one that became Tullett Prebon and now ICAP, whatever they call them now, TP ICAP. And then back into the Building Society sector with Portman Building Society, then with Anglo-Irish Bank, then into RBS in lots of different places in RBS, and finally finished my executive career as CFO in a Spanish credit card specialized bank, which was a digital bank that actually took on all the credit card and consumer finance business of Citibank. And who else was it? I really should remember this, shouldn't I? It was Citi and Barclays in Spain and Portugal. So that was a really fascinating way to close my account, as it were.
So you've seen a lot over the years, been in a lot of places. How has the role of the treasurer changed over that period? What was a treasurer 30 years ago doing, and what do you think a treasurer might do now?
I suppose there are a couple of aspects to that. One relates to the amount of risk that was taken in Treasury, so therefore, you know, the Treasury mandate in itself. And the other relates to its overall place in the business. So, I mean, back then, Treasury used to manage the risks. They used to help fund the bank, and they ran the liquidity portfolio. And there was a lot more active trading that was involved in that. So larger organizations had quite significant proprietary trading desks. So not only were they serving a need for the core bank, but they were also in it for themselves, and a lot of them were profit centers. As time has gone on, and of course, regulation has, let's put it in inverted commas, improved, that type of overt trading has reduced. I think we all know that. But I think now the Treasurer and the Treasury Department have become far better integrated with the core businesses that they support. So they are business focused. In an ideal world, they will be very important in terms of the strategy of the bank. There's more focus on what a Treasury would do. I mean, for example, you now have commentators and analysts thinking very hard about how well a bank is structurally set up and how well it hedges itself. You know, so examination of structural hedge techniques, for example, might take a few pages of an analyst report when looking at banking performance. So there's a much greater connection with the business, as I say. So, and what goes along with that, of course, if you want to be successful as a treasurer, is that you have to have the ability to understand what the core business and the people in it are trying to achieve, and not to approach the task as what I've seen sometimes as an inflexible technical analyst. You know, it really does need to be a partnership. So interpersonal skills and stakeholder management skills are very important as important, I would contend, as technical treasury skills.
Now, given that there's been a lot of change over time, that one assumes means you've got to make decisions about teams and the types of teams you want around you, and if you're in different types of firms, what those teams are doing. So how do you approach that challenge of building teams?
I think the end game is always the same. You want to be in, or if you've got some part of helping to build a team, you want to build a team that performs as well as it can in support of the organisation and your own treasury-related objectives. But the differences lie in, I suppose, the cycle that you're in, and also the type of firm you're in and where it is in terms of its condition. Some of my jobs have been, in fact, rarely have I gone into a role where the foundations are very strong. It's normally been a situation where something needed to be repaired, but there were variations. So I would start with a blank sheet of paper and think, right, okay, so how can we set ourselves up ideally in order to be effective and successful? But do that in the context of growth, because, okay, having your ideal departmental structure in place for the first 12 months, well, you are going to need to change that over time. You may have a relatively strong growth ambition within the business, so you need to support that. So what I've always tried to do is look further down the track, at least 3, maybe out to 5 years, in terms of, well, everything that the department needs, but certainly in terms of the people that you need in it. So to try and plan that evolution over that time, but also to make sure that the team has in it a good mix of technical experience, those stakeholder management skills that I mentioned earlier, and is also a fertile ground for development. Because, of course, what you don't want to do is always need to, you know, get the checkbook out and go out to the external market to fill your important positions. I mean, sometimes, of course, you will have no choice. And indeed, it's always good to bring in fresh blood, new ideas and experience from other organizations. But to have that great mix where you can show the people that you've recruited in the junior and middle positions that there is a great career and super learning. It might not always be a promotional step. It could be sideways in order to get that development. And I think in the Treasury Department, the development across different disciplines, be it liquidity, funding, marketing, interest rate or foreign exchange management and trading, very important that you get ideally all of those, but certainly some of them, to help you build that strong foundation for future career development in that organization or others. So, and the other thing I would say is, if you have an important position to fill, wait until you've got the right person. Don't make a hasty decision. Or if you go out to market and you say, well, you know, these are the 3 best, but none of them are ideal, take a breath and start again, because it's never that important.
Now, earlier on, Dave, you told us that you worked in a number of organisations. Every time you swap organisations, you could argue you're taking a risk. You know the organisation you're in, and you're taking a new risk by going to that new organisation. You may not know people. So that is taking a risk. But what do you consider to be the biggest risk you've taken in your career?
Well, I don't know, Chris. Do you want? I could give you 2 answers. I could give you a career answer, and I could give you an event answer. Maybe I'll give you both. I'll start with the event answer. You know, I keep referring to things that happened way back, just emphasizing my age here, but this goes back to 1993 and connected with the UK's exit from the exchange rate mechanism. Now, back then we were, for those who don't know, we were tied to some extent to the valuation of a basket of currencies without actually being formally part of a structure such as the euro. What happened was the UK economy was out of step. There was pressure on various parts of it. And the medicine that the politicians thought was appropriate was to increase interest rates. This is a big subject, so I won't talk any more about it than that. But what happened on one particular day was that interest rates rose by 500 basis points. When I say interest rates, I'm talking about the central bank base rate increased by 500 basis points in a matter of hours. And that was late afternoon to early evening on one particular day. So as you can imagine, you know, there was chaos. So the biggest risk I took was around events that happened then, because there was some very active trading that happened throughout that evening into the early hours of the next morning. And a number of banks in what I've already described as that very active sterling money market were dealing with each other during that period. And the interest rate volatility was incredible, such that overnight transactions went through at over 100% interest rate. And people were borrowing 1 month money for, I think the peak came to about 32%. So there were some opportunities to take advantage of that. And of course, it's a bit of a nil-sum game. Some banks did well during that period, some didn't. But I took a number of risks by pushing to the limits of the bank's risk appetite during that period. And you might say luck would have it, we did okay, but that was a risk. But in terms of the career risk, it was my first journey out of what I would call a regulated bank building society environment, when I tried something new, which was to join a firm of interdealer brokers, which were at the time the second largest firm globally, about 30 offices throughout the world, not only dealing in money market instruments, but all sorts of things like cargo, carbon credits, even back then, and providing services to financial services firms, corporates and governments, ranging from project finance, structured finance, training, you know, lots of things. So it was a very complex environment, but a very different culture. And I thought it was one that was going to be very interesting and useful. I mean, it certainly turned out to be both of those things.
Probably worth adding, actually, I spoke to somebody who also was there when sterling fell out the exchange rate mechanism. And he recalls probably a little bit of a similar moment to you. I think he was actually said he'd been at the Bank of England and said that during the morning, interest rates had risen, whatever it was, 5 or 6% in a day. They rushed back to work. And he said when they rushed back to work, they realised effectively the bank was insolvent at that level. The next morning, of course, they went in fearing the worst. But I believe quite soon after that, interest rates fell substantially, because we moved out of the exchange rate mechanism. The interest rates didn't need to be kept quite so high to protect the value of the pound. And he said after they were cut by quite a lot, they had their most profitable day ever. And I can't remember if this was 1 or 2 days later, but he said the champagne was flowing. And yet a couple of days before, they thought they're effectively bust. So amazing amount of risk.
Yeah, well, absolutely, Chris. You know, you're helping me to remember that now, because what happened was a lot of banks were, let's just say, overexposed when things closed down around, I don't know, midnight, 1 o'clock after those events. And some had a position on, I'll confess that my organization did, that if the, as was then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, didn't calm markets down by reducing interest rates the next morning, then there would have been a lot of failed organizations. You know, that was the basis on which we established our position. And that expectation actually happened. So when the markets were calm the next morning, things started to settle down. But depending on where you were, you either came out of that well or less well.
We all learn lots of things, Dave, when we go through experiences such as that, which are highly memorable. All of us have picked up those type of experiences. But what do you consider to be the single most valuable experience during the course of your career?
I've already mentioned it was my move to the interdealer broker, which I have to say I found it was the most challenging period of my career. Some of that experience was very difficult on an emotional level as well, because I was certainly at the start of it very much out of my comfort zone. But what I learned was that everything I'd done up to that point and the techniques I'd used, particularly in terms of managing people or just interacting with people, didn't work nearly as well because of the what I found extreme differences in culture. So my toolkit just didn't work in that environment. I'll give you an example of that. I was responsible for an area that had a lot of functioning dealing desks, broking desks, that made good money, but there were also a whole bunch of other businesses dotted around Europe that were not making money and needed immediate attention. So I made a mistake. You might call it a logical mistake, but the mistake was, where do I need to go and put out fires? And where is everything good? I'm going to spend all my time putting out the fires. So I was sort of flying around Europe, trying to close off these problems and limit risks. But I omitted to spend enough time with the guys who were making good money. So therefore, it took me probably around 6 months to get those guys on side. I explained what I was doing when I came in, what I was going to do, but they weren't used to that level of openness in the way that they'd been managed in the past. So they didn't know me well enough to trust me. It took about 6 months for that to unwind, but that 6 months was the hardest period of my career, where it seemed like I'm doing 16-hour days and nobody really supported what I was doing. So I battled through that. But I came out of it with some success at that firm. Things did start to turn around and, you know, good relationships were formed. But it just told me, right, okay, wherever you go next, think very carefully about how you're going to choose your priorities and how you're going to engage with people. So that was without question the most difficult, uncomfortable, but by a long distance, the most valuable period of my career.
You've done lots of things there, and some of them are valuable and very memorable. But what is your proudest achievement? Let's say, I'm sure you've been proud of many achievements, but what would be the most notable one?
Proud. It's funny that, Chris, because I never really sit down and think, proud of that. You know, a lot of people don't. You just do something and move on to the next thing. But you've asked me to look back, so I will. And again, I'm afraid it's in the dim and distant. It's that ERM exit day. That's the proudest moment. Not because of, you know, I called the market right or anything like that. It's because in the preceding 3 years, I was involved in building a team. And on that occasion, the team were fantastic. What happened was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Norman Lamont, I think, stood on the steps of the Treasury and announced the first of two emergency interest rate hikes. This was, I can't remember the exact time, but it was something like about 5:30 in the afternoon when the equity markets had closed. And at about 6 o'clock, I'd got money brokers phoning me up saying, do you know what's going on? Are you going back into the office? I thought, yes, I better go back into the office. By that time, the team that I was working with, and this were about six money market dealers, had all heard this on the news and decided to go back to work. So they didn't need my encouragement. So they're all back in work. So all we got back there and responded to events and transacted our way through the evening. And for the first time, I don't think I personally executed one transaction. I just sat back and watched them. I guess I was holding the baton to some extent, but I was just sitting back looking at the team and just being immensely proud of what they could do. And it told me two things. Well, great. How much satisfaction I got out of that, just out of what other people were doing. And it also told me, well, perhaps it's time to start thinking about what I did next, because I didn't think they needed me much after that. It was a great day.
So that sounds like a success that you should be proud of. Can you draw out any other areas of success that you've looked back? Maybe some of them in the treasury space.
I'd like to answer that question slightly differently, Chris. If I look back, and I have looked back on my career and thought, you know, have I been successful? Well, how do you measure it? I mean, do you measure it in terms of promotions, positions, bonuses, accreditations? I don't, actually. I'd like to think about success in terms of how effective you were at your job. You know, how much did you influence the outcome? And was that outcome good? So I look back on it with very mixed feelings, because I think ultimately the success of a treasurer or a treasury department is how much you help to produce good outcomes for the business and for the customers of that business. So that's why I've got a mixed experience. You're only really successful, I think, if you can properly connect with the business. So that's why I go back to what I said earlier about influencing skills and stakeholder management capability. because without it, you're very unlikely to be successful. And it's absolutely vital that you've got a C-suite that are interested and knowledgeable and understanding and sympathetic to what you're trying to do. And if you haven't got that, particularly in the CEO and CFO, then you're really going to struggle. So when I look back on the best parts of my career, it's when I've found that, when I've had a boss, and they've typically been CEOs or CFOs, who get what we're trying to do and support it, and as I say, are advocates of what we're trying to do. So sometimes that's gone well, sometimes it's gone less well, Chris. But I would say towards the end of my career, I probably got better at it. And going back to the team building, again, towards the end of my career, I deliberately hired people who were very good at that. And I think that certainly helped influence the outcome.
Treasury in itself has been quite different over time. Certainly when I first started Treasury, I mean, sort of a lot of it was just market risks, you know, what you might call ALM, sometimes called interest rate risk in the banking book. And over the last few years, we've come to think much more about liquidity, much more about funding. Capital's made its way into the Treasury area, and maybe even recovery and resolution. Different banks will have different setups, of course. But where do you see the future of Treasury?
Well, you're right, Chris. The funding, liquidity, structural risk management, they've always been there, and I guess they always will be. Going back to my previous comments, I think it will be increasingly strategic, and hopefully the treasurer and colleagues are very involved in the strategic planning and management of the organization. Because there's a whole bunch of other stuff coming down the track, AI, digital currencies, and increasingly unpredictable, I think, customer behavior. So that core treasury skill sets are still going to be very important. But I think it's just going to be an extension of what I mentioned earlier about the importance of making good connections and making it clear that treasury processes are integral to the overall organization and properly linked into it. One thing I have noticed, actually, and in the sorts of people that are taking senior treasury positions now, less of them are coming from accounting type backgrounds and maybe more from backgrounds where advocacy is a key skill. So, you know, a couple of the UK clearing banks have experienced capital markets practitioners as treasurers now. I think that's an interesting trend, probably a trend that's reflective of that stakeholder management and advocacy requirement.
I don't think there's any doubt that if you work in the world of treasury, especially if you work in the funds transfer pricing, advocacy is part of that process.
Oh, my goodness. You've mentioned those three letters. FTP, yeah.
That's a whole selection of podcasts by itself. Moving on to just a few slightly more wider questions. You know, people are listening here, they might want to take away. What about the best treasury-related book that you've ever found useful?
Personally, I've always been surrounded by people who are great technical experts and know a lot more than I do or did about various elements. So I much prefer to sit next to someone and talk through an issue and they can sort of dump all their experience and knowledge on me. So the sort of the key elements of treasury capability, I think I've been able to acquire directly. But other things that are perhaps a little bit more peripheral, then maybe I'll go outside. So one book that I've always used as a key reference point is Principles of Corporate Finance by Brearley and Myers. Now, that book is over 30 years old, but there's not much in there that isn't relevant to today. I think that's the one book that I've found really useful.
And what about advice? Someone's listening here, they're thinking, I want to be like Dave Stanell into the future. What advice would you give them if they're just sort of at the start of their treasury career?
I certainly hesitate to recommend or suggest that anyone would want to be in any way like me. I hope they're as lucky as me. That's certainly one thing. I think it's like seek out a good learning and experience in the right type of organizations. And they're not always successful firms. You can learn an awful lot in a firm that's having some challenges. depending on where you are in the cycle, sometimes you'll find it difficult to find a firm that isn't having significant challenges. So the good times and the bad times, you can learn an awful lot. In some ways, you learn more in the bad times, certainly about people. Education is absolutely vital. And now we've got ALMA-related education in open dedicated sources, but also very importantly in our qualification. I'm saying our qualification. The CERT BARM, that's definitely useful. I said this earlier, I think, building that foundation of knowledge through your Treasury career in the various elements of it is never going to leave you in a bad place. But perhaps one thing that I wished I'd done a little more actively is take risks with my career, because Treasury skills are very, I think they're very adaptable to different environments. And Treasury professionals are in a small band of people working in financial institutions who are in a position to understand how the whole organization works. You can find some people who are very senior in banks and building societies who struggle to really understand how all the pieces interrelate. But, you know, Treasury professionals are rarely those. It's a very good place to understand how the whole thing works.
These days, there's always a lot of talk about getting a mentor to try and help you along your career journey. Did you have a mentor? And if so, did they help you?
I only had a mentor when I started to move into more senior positions. So only in the last around 20 years. I wasn't in firms at that time who had a good mentoring structure within them. I think that's come along in, you know, more recent times. But I had externally provided mentors who were, you know, specialist mentors who I did find useful for bouncing ideas off or helping me with particular issues. But I think I took more inspiration from role models, and there were a handful of those. Wherever you work, they will exist. I won't embarrass them by naming them, Chris, if you don't mind. But I did have two or three very strong role models who imbued me, I hope, with one or two good habits and practices.
Now, in some respects, the question I'll ask you, you might have, to an extent, answered already. You kind of talked about maybe taking more risk with your future at the time, if you'd look back. But if you could do it all again, is there anything slightly more fundamentally you'd do differently? Would you go into a different area or a different part of finance? Or how would you think about that?
The answer to that, Chris, is yes, I would do it differently. So, and this is, I suppose, largely circumstantial. You know, I've had quite a few jobs in quite a few different organizations. Now, that might suggest that, you know, I've been actively thinking about my career development and making choices around that. Well, that was rarely the case. What usually happened was there was a corporate event, normally a takeover of some sort, and I responded to it. And more often than not, that worked out. But I always got pretty bored with any job I was doing after 2 or 3 years and wanted to move on to something else that I found interesting and challenging. As I say, luckily, that happened not down to my instigation, but it just happened because of other events. And again, purely out of luck, I got a bunch of different experiences that gave me a fairly broad experience of banking throughout my career. Now, so what would I do different? I think I would plan it out. And I think about the things that I would need to do to build the career I wanted. I made a very big mistake. It was about 25 years ago. I was working for a firm as treasurer, and the CFO said, look, I'm thinking about my own succession, and I've got two guys who report to me, with me and someone else, and neither of you are qualified accountants. And I think it might be an idea if you thought about doing that, and that would set you in good stead for not only your own career, but you never know, you might end up succeeding me when I retire. And I said to my boss, the CFO, thank you very much. That's very generous. But no, thank you. And why did I say that? Because I looked at what he did and I looked at what I did. And I thought, I'd much rather do what I do than what you do. And I mistakenly thought that the CFO's role, which was, what this particular individual did. Now, mistake one. Mistake two was, why would I? Absolutely crazy, because then a few years went by and I started to get a little bit frustrated about my lack of influence in the organizations I was working in. So effectively, I think I blocked my route to CEO by not becoming a CFO. That probably wouldn't have happened anyway, but I made it an awful lot harder by not taking that opportunity. So that was a bit dumb. And so I'd certainly do that differently if I had my time again. So if you get that type of opportunity, certainly one where a firm is willing to invest in your development, then think carefully about it before you turn it down.
Now, Dave, you've done an awful lot of things in an awful lot of places over quite a long time. I won't say an awful long time, but you've sort of moved away from the day-to-day roles in banks. What are you actually doing now?
My last full-time role was the CFO role out in Spain. And leaving that, I thought, well, that's it. I am absolutely not going to work full-time again because I thought I'd done enough of it. However, I can't get this stuff out of my blood. So I initially started doing a bit of consultancy for small banks and then took on a couple of non-exec roles. One's at, funnily enough, an interdealer broker, and the other one's at Building Society. And I find them both really enjoyable. Funnily enough, I'm currently in a conversation with a bank about taking on an advisory role. And what is that advisory role about? It's about balance sheet management, strategy, and what they do or don't do in treasury. And why am I interested in doing that? Not because I'd rather not be on the golf course. It's just because I find it really interesting having those types of conversations and trying to help people through some of those issues. I think what my treasury career has left me with is a lifelong interest in the subject and the good that it can do ultimately for customers of financial firms. But also, one thing I haven't mentioned yet, Chris, is throughout a quite long career, as you describe it, 99% of the people that I've come into contact with have been talented, motivated, ethical, and just great people to spend time with trying to solve problems.
Well, Dave, hopefully, and I'm sure there will, lots of people that have been listening to this will get something out of it and able to take bits and pieces that will help them over their career. So thank you for your time today. I appreciate it. And well, good luck with whatever the next move is.
Thanks for the opportunity, and I've very much enjoyed it. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon. And in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?